Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we love to talk about teaching multilingual learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferrone Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the EML team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Our Burning Questions for today are, how has teaching emergent multilingual learners in early childhood changed over the years? And how can we support our families of English language learners or multilingual learners, especially in early childhood? And here to respond to these questions is my very special guest, Suzanne Marcus. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you, Colette. Very lovely to be here with you.
Yes, it's wonderful to have you. So, Suzanne, could you please tell us a little bit about yourself, your title, your role, your position, your story? What's your areas of interest and what drew you to working with ELLES?
Okay, so yeah, I'll try to be as short as possible. What drew me was that I was a FSL student, in French as a second language student, as a teenager. And I was taunted because I really hadn't studied French. I had studied Spanish in New York. And I was studying, and then eventually studied linguistics at the Fac des Lettres in Nancy, France, which is in the northeastern part of France, and decided that, you know, I was helping people learn English in France and came back to the States to realize there was a whole field called ESL. Mm-hmm. And I pursued a master's degree in TESOL. And have been, I started at the higher ed level, teaching at Queen's College and CUNY and Hunter College, and then kind of worked my way in. I worked in a school district, mm-hmm. The first district just east of New York City in Great Neck. And I had a long and wonderful, wonderful career teaching K through 12 and some pre-K, because they do have a preschool, in specifically ESL, which is now called ENL, we know, mm-hmm. and officially retired from the system in 2018, just under the wire before COVID, mm-hmm. and continue to work doing staff development PDs for the teacher center there. And I do a lot of community outreach and work with the Fordham University Center for Educational Partnerships. Okay. So that's what I do. Actually past president twice of New York State TESOL, and that's an organization very dear to my heart. I think that's where we connected again, right?
Yes. Yep. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's pretty much the story. My interests really are everything ESL, everything. myself having lived in other parts of the world and hearing stories about my father and how he struggled trying to learn different languages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it spans from early childhood to SIFE young adults who are trying to learn English. In the summer, I work with a SIFE Institute program that's a grant funded program for older arrivals of kids who qualify for high school till they're 21. And I try to do a lot of interaging. I also worked in something called early intervention, mm-hmm. for a while, which is kids birth to 2.9 years old from culturally linguistically diverse families to figure out how we can best help these students who didn't appear to be developing language the way one would expect. So, right. That's what I'm here to, you know, it's just my calling. I love all forms of communication, mm-hmm. languages, even within New York State. I can hear that you speak a little differently than I do, upstate, downstate.
Yep.
My mother was Canadian, so we okay. used to, yeah.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, I feel like I share that love of language with you. Mm-hmm. And it seems like your path through your education was kind of similar to mine, because I also started teaching at the college level as well. Uh-huh. And then I went to K-12 after that to get my ENL certification. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. And I often tell people I worked my way up from mm-hmm. teaching high school or, teaching at the higher ed to preschool. And they say, what do you mean up? Most people don't realize that it's much more cognitively demanding to work with a young child who's developing what languages in the first place, let alone a second or third language, because you're helping them figure out how to make sense of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't have the foundation cognitively that an older learner has.
Right.
Most people think that the teachers who work with 3 to 5 year olds are playing all day and sitting on the floor with blocks. It's actually much more complex.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly why I wanted to talk to you and have you share your ideas about this, because it's an important point of life. It's an important, stage of development for all children, whether you speak English or not. And I'm very excited to have you presenting at our 2023 Symposium on Emergent Multilingual Learners in Early Childhood in February.
Right.
So I kind of looped you into the podcast as well. So
yeah, here I am.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So in your experience, how has teaching emergent multilingual learners in early childhood changed over the years? How has it evolved?
Wow. So I feel kind of old when someone asked me that, because I have to say that teaching has evolved because the world has evolved, and the world has changed largely because of the internet.
Right.
So our world has gotten smaller and more connected, but at the same time, some ways less connected in a very interesting way. So I think emotionally we're less connected because people think they have friends that are on a screen as opposed to in person and spending real time walking arm in arm or something, you know?
Yeah.
So our schools, I think, have evolved in that now most schools in New York State have students from linguistically, culturally diverse backgrounds or just a variety of backgrounds, whereas maybe 20 years ago, there was less diversity within the schools. You know, the world is smaller and people are moving more.
Yeah. That's true. I also think, too, the perspective has changed, too, that maybe there was diversity, right? And now it's being seen more and acknowledged more as well.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And people didn't fully, they might not have understood why that was important, you know, to like the whole blank slate thing. You come in and you just teach them from where they are in front of you instead of realizing that everyone comes in with a rich story.
Right. Yes. And that's important to keep in mind for sure, especially with English language learners, because they are so unique, just like all of our students are unique. English language learners are unique in that way as well. We talked about the perspective. So that's the perspective that's changed as well. When we talk about emergent multilinguals, what do we mean when we say that?
Well, first, if we go back also, if we can, to just the perspective, I think what's happened too is that we've kind of come full circle, because historically, we know in this country there always were people who came in and spoke other languages.
Right.
But the notion, and way back in the day, I don't want to go into a history thing, but we did in some states have German-American schools and schools like that. And then we went through a period where it was considered un-American to have any other background but English, USA.
Mm.
And so historically, you were considered un-American if you wanted to maintain your home language. And I think with the civil rights movements in the end of the 50s and the 60s really helped to celebrate. And if you remember, I'm old enough to remember those big round pins in the early 60s that said, kiss me, I'm Irish American.
I remember those, yeah.
American, okay. And that was just really interesting to say, like, it's okay to be a hyphenated American as long as, you know, you don't do too much of your home country kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's just very, very interesting what's happened. Mm-hmm. I think we know so much more now about how our brains work, that back in the day, the thought was you can't have two languages, because if you have kind of two brains and if you fill it too much with Polish language, then you're not going to be able to learn English because you won't have room or you'll be confused.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that people around the world grow up, my family in Europe, grow up with 2 or 3 languages, and they're not geniuses, mind you. they're just regular kids who are exposed to multiple languages.
Right.
And, one more than one language we know now is actually enriching. It's not confusing. So that's, that's taken a huge, it's had a huge impact on the way our schools work, hopefully, right? Hopefully, all teachers, like we know the blueprint tells us, all teachers are teachers of L. So we know that the home language is, in fact, the foundation upon which any other language is built. And then we know about what does it mean to be proficient in a language, and that's really what I have come to be amazed and fascinated by in sharing that information that we in the field of linguistics and ESL and TESOL know, and other teachers working in school systems to teach content area or literacy or math and science, they don't know what this fixed calc developmentally appropriate deficiency is, common underlying proficiency, relative language proficiency. These are critical things that everyone working in a school system, from the custodial staff to the bus matrons to the district leaders, need to have an understanding that the ability to speak and make small talk, chit chat, is not going to correlate with the ability to do cause and effect sequencing and write an essay.
And I
So
also
that's
want to,
changed for.
yeah, I also want to add too that knowing another language is a higher cognitive function. To be able to switch back and
100%.
forth from those from the from one language to another is a higher cognitive function. So it really like makes more neurological connections in the brain.
Correct. But when people don't understand it, they view it as confusion.
Yeah, and I think you don't really clearly understand it unless you've tried to learn another language yourself.
Right. 100%.
So, kind of transitioning into emergent multilingual learners, we talk about that term. We use it a lot, but what does it mean? And it means different things for different people. But in New York State, we refer to emergent multilingual learners as well. Why don't you? Can you share what your understanding of emergent multilingual learners is?
My understanding is actually, in a very broad sense, multilingual or emergent multilingual learners can be referred to all of us, because language is not stagnant. Language is alive. And as is studying linguistics, language is ever changing, reflecting a people, a culture, a society, right? So it's a more positive term in terms of, you could say, emerging multilinguals, but we're all sort of process, if you will, of emerging. If you just look at English only, look at how this is true with our own language in terms of using the to say, you know what, Colette, I'm going to fax you something. And if you just think of the word fax without its even spelling, it's like, wait, fax versus opinion. What do you mean fax something to me? Like, that was a verb I learned as an adult, because it became a verb, because its language is arbitrary, right? So we're always emerging with that. But it's especially true for children learning multiple languages at a young age, because we're all emerging. And it seems that the younger brain, and we know this from maybe Lindenberg and the lateralization of the hemispheres of the brain, they have a propensity, they have an ability to develop one aspect of language in with greater ease than older people do. There's some discussion about pre-puberty and after puberty and so on, but that's, really getting into neurolinguistics and so on. But I think it makes sense, because some students come in and they've studied a lot of English from different countries, but it's written English and they can't speak very well. That was my experience. I taught in China as one of the first non-Chinese people to go there as part of a North American Gateway program. And my so-called students were teachers of English. They studied a minimum of 15 years. They could write a flawless essay. But if I said, how are you doing today? They totally were thrown by that, because they studied, dialogue A and dialogue B from British English. They'd never met a native speaker, let alone from the US. So it's just, it's very different. Language is always changing. And for the younger children, they absorb it at different levels than adults, and they don't have that affective filter that gets them nervous. They just want to play.
Right. And that's also important too, that affective filter, right? Because we sometimes will have a presupposition that because they don't speak English, that they can't learn. Right. And so that can pose a barrier sometimes too. So with that in mind, what are important considerations that we need to keep in mind?
I'm really going to say that the first and foremost, and I say this in PDs and graduate courses where there's all this, you know, CALA and SIOP method and all these fancy terms for language goals, for your content goals, but the key, the essence of teaching, which is not only happening in schools, mind you, it happens in the world outside of school. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, it's relationships. Relationships are at the heart of teaching, right? And school systems need to understand that children are not born at 3 years old when they start preschool or Head Start. State ed needs to understand they're not born at 5 years old or six when they start kindergarten.
Right.
There's a whole host of things that have happened the first 60 months that they've been on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
5 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Who were their connections to? What kind of relationships did they have? Because early infancy is when language starts.
Right.
Developmentally, people will really actually say it starts in utero. It's one of the first senses of the sensory system to develop is the sense of hearing.
Mm.
So it's so interesting, you know? So all life experiences prior to entering a group setting have to be considered, right? When we think about teaching all students, in particular, multilingual learners, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to, all of us, to be curious about prior experiences, not nosy, not prying on what was your story, why did you come here, but be curious about past experiences. There's something in the brain that happens called serve and return. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's about even beginning with feeding, you know, you nurse a baby or your body bottle feed a baby, and the baby seems to be, the caregiver seems to be quiet while the baby is suck swallow. Then when the baby comes up for air, the caregiver starts talking again. Do you like that? Do you feel better? Do you need to burp? It's very interesting. That's the beginning of the serve and return of turn taking and gaze and eye contact and all of those things. And the assumption is that when you start teaching 3-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 12-year-olds, that they've all had that. But we have to just be curious. Did they have consistent caregiving that developed the brain the way we expect it to go, with serve and return, with taking turns, with one person talks at a time, and all of those school behaviors that teachers complain about when they come in and they don't have them?
Right. And what you were saying there also made me think about the emergent multilingual learner pre-K profile screener.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the types of questions that are asked on that form. Same and almost, you know, similar to what's on the home language questionnaire, but that screener before kindergarten really collects that information.
Wow, interesting. I don't know it as well as for the, you know, school age, but I will say this. I think all of these screeners, it's critical that the family members answering them understand the rationale for these questions. We're not expecting you to say, oh, no, we only speak in. We're just being curious, and it's going to help us develop the best program for your son or daughter. That's what it's about.
Yes,
you know, because yes. Sometimes people feel like those screeners are used as a gotcha, you know, or to say we can accept you or we can't, which has nothing to do with the situation.
Right.
Hopefully.
Yes. Oh, and also emphasizes the importance of having an interpreter there as well.
Oh, so that yes.
They understand, right?
Yep, absolutely. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. What kind of specific support do our early learners need?
Our early learners, first and foremost, need to have an environment in which they feel safe. They need to have an environment where they can trust the big people around them, the adults, all of them, all of them. They need to feel that they can get their needs met in a calm way, right? They need to know that whoever dropped them off in the family is going to come back and pick them up. Mm. They're not going to be left, because a lot of kids have experienced being left with different people and adults in their lives coming and going. Mm. So there's a disconnect. You know, there's the other piece of the serve and return and the early development that happens as precursors to writing, as precursors to language, rather, is all the forms of attachment that a lot of us as K-12 teachers haven't been trained to do. Like, most teacher programs don't really cover early development, especially if you're going for a 7 to 12 certification.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. if your undergraduate degree was in English and you decide to be an English teacher, it's unlikely that you're going to have a course on early attachment and early brain development, you know, unless you have a minor in psychology or something. But the notion of understanding, you know, Maslow before Bloom and all of those developmental pieces, those are critical in what all learners know need. But in particular, the learner at the early childhood level who comes in without understanding the language of that program, it's understandable. They would feel completely lost and unable to get their needs met and non-trusting. So best case scenario is you need somebody there who can communicate with them in the language they have at the moment in time.
It's interesting that you talk about first language acquisition, because I'm thinking back to my own, you know, my own education. And when I was working on the master's in linguistics, one of the courses that I was required to take was first language acquisition.
Mm.
And that just makes me think about, okay, so I was taking first language acquisition because I was concentrating in TESOL, but what are other programs offering with respect to that first language acquisition?
Yeah, I mean, it's curious. When I was on the executive board of NICE TESOL, we met with the regents office and talking about, this was before Part 155 was revised, and we were talking about, well, what are the most critical courses that teachers of multilingual learners would need? Mm. You know, and then that was just prior to the discussion of, because there's a paucity of ENL teachers, we're going to make this quick path to certification. And they went from a full master's requirement to the 15 or 18 credits or whatever. Right. And, you know, from a personal level, I have to tell you, I don't think that was fully the best way to do this, you know.
Yeah.
If they were going to do it, they still need to ensure that certain critical courses of first language development, or the impact of what the dimensions of language proficiency are, what are their impacts on academic success. That should be part of a prerequisite pre-teaching, pre-service course for everybody who's going into teaching. Because my experience with mentoring teachers is that I can see a difference between people with a full master's, because there's more linguistics courses, mm-hmm. and someone who has the certificate extension on their other teaching license. I guess that's another podcast talk.
Yeah. Yes, for sure. For sure. Absolutely. And I'll add that to my list.
Right. But I, you know, getting back to what they need, I think we all have to recognize and remind ourselves, regardless of the age of the students in front of us, families are our first teachers. Mm-hmm. Families are their first teachers. And it's, you know, I do an activity with in-service teachers, and I ask them to just stop for a minute. And so I ask you, can you recall something that you learned as a child at home? What is something you learned at home outside of school? And so, you know, people say riding a bike, or any life lesson, that the stove is hot, or using chalk on the sidewalk, and then it rained, and crying because the rain washed the chalk away. So it's very interesting, you know. And
Yeah.
then we look at, remember your earliest, what's your earliest memory of learning something at school? And the important thing here is not what you learned. It's think about where you were and who was your teacher at that time. And how did you feel? And so usually it's when you felt loved, when you felt you mattered, when you felt you were safe, is when you learned the most.
I love that.
So that's really important. It's important to, you know, early learning happens with the earliest moments. How is a baby held? Who responds when the baby cries? How is the baby fed? Who does for the baby? Is the baby, as a toddler, encouraged to self-feed with the pincer grasp, you know, to give the self, himself or herself the Cheerios? Or is someone always there to give it to him? So it's, is it independence or interdependence on other family members? All of these things in early programs, we need to think about, you know, when is a baby weaned? What's a good age to stop? I mean, and that's interesting. Or potty train, because a lot of programs won't take them if they're still
right.
Type.
Right.
So, you know, some of these things have to do with kids' belief, families' beliefs about
right.
the role of children. Another thing we talk about in some of these workshops is, you know, think about Thanksgiving. Think about the holidays coming up. Did your family have a kids' table? What age did you move from the kids' table to the adult table? And what does that say about the expectations of children sitting with adults?
Yeah.
You know, or did the kids get fed early and then go off with a babysitter and go to sleep? Or, you know, who knows?
Right.
But all of this reflects beliefs about the role children play in the family. And how does that role match or not match the expectations of behavior we have in an early childhood setting?
And I was giggling when you said the kids' table, because I was thinking back to my own childhood and have family gatherings and being at the kids' table for a long time.
Right. And then thinking, how old do you have to be to get off the kids' table?
Right. And was it just because there wasn't enough space at the big
Right.
table that they just put the kids at the smaller table? You know, what is that?
Right.
And I think that and that kind of leads to another idea that a lot of it is cultural, right? A lot of, like you said, the beliefs at home, and then a lot of that is based in culture.
100%. Yep.
Yeah. So, why is it so important to have knowledge of a child's home language literacy? What's important about that?
Okay. What's important about that is children's exposure to print will vary,
mm-hmm.
right? Some have been read to daily, some have been sung to with chants and rhymes, and others have not. And it's irrelevant in which language this is happening, because language is language. And learning to read, by the way, is an event that happens only once in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
If, and we know that for older school age kids, if they come in with fully developed CALP or literacy skills in their home language, or L1, they'll have an easier time transferring it over to English, because you only learn to develop the skill to read once, which is making meaning from symbols or print, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some youngsters have seen people making meaning from print more often than others. Some have been exposed to more environmental print than others. Some have seen the adults in their environment interact with writing tools more often than others. And we write for multiple purposes all the time, and we read for multiple purposes all the time, even if it's reading the label on a can of food in the supermarket.
Right.
So children learn early on that when you look at those little lines on the box of cereal or rice to see what's the sugar content, what's the fat content, what's the, you know, how much information is on there, the child is witnessing somebody getting information from somewhere. And we can't assume that everyone has equal access to all of those literacy experiences, let's say, right? And again, it doesn't matter what language it's in. It's the idea of witnessing people making meaning from print, right? Mm-hmm. So what examples of print are around the student? And it doesn't always have to be print in terms of language. It could be songs that the child could relate to, rhymes, starting a sentence and waiting for the child to finish it, using language that's at a higher level than the child himself or herself can produce, having rich models of language, not speaking, you know, like Tarzanese, if you will, like, because you think that this is a child who doesn't understand. So you say, no, you sit, me, teacher, I go. Like, that's not how we talk in those models. So sometimes, you know, people who are not used to working with young children who don't speak English have a tendency, you know, the joke is in New York City, they're on the corner asking for directions and someone tries to help them and they're yelling at them.
Right.
You try to say they're not deaf, they just don't speak English.
Right.
You know, there's nothing. But remember that literacy skills are built upon oracy, talking.
Yes.
And how does the child use language to get her needs met, to control the behavior of others, to ask questions, to inquire? How the child uses language and how it's responded to is really important. And oracy is that foundation for literacy. In fact, there's a whole movement now, particularly in the UK and Australia, in looking at oracy the way you look at literacy with the levels and degrees. So I think songs in the home language, displaying print in the classroom of examples of the home languages of the children. And people will say to me, but they can't read. What's the point? And I'm like, wait. Younger children can't read yet, but the parents see these signs and they feel welcomed. They feel acknowledged, right? And some students, even as young as three, will actually pick up the difference between English and their home language, even though they can't read, but the lines look the same. Even the diacritical markings, like the accent marks. I've worked with pre-K kids who can tell me, I have two versions of the book, Brown Bear, Brown Bear, and they can tell me, no, that one is Papi's language, this one is school. Because they see the accent marks and they know, oh, that's Spanish. Because they've seen that kind of writing with the marks on top of the letters at home, and at school, it doesn't have them. So they are very astute. They're more observant than we think. And because they are, we have to be better language detectives about the home environment.
Right.
You know, gone are the days when people are doing home visits, if you will.
Yeah.
Right? Pre-K programs used to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They stopped, and then with COVID, there's no way, and I don't know that they'll come back.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a really good way to connect with families. In terms of supporting them.
Yeah, you get a whole sense of what that environment is in general, social, emotional, you know, where their needs are, how they're being met. But it also is a good way to take a look at the literacy environment around them.
Right.
Are there books around? Is there a different form of writing around? I mean, even I remember going in to a home back in the day because I'm old already. I've been doing this over 30 years. And I remember the coupons, you know, people used to clip the coupons, not digital coupons, paper.
Yep.
And I thought this is a great way to look at environmental print, the picture of the macaroni and cheese and then the macaroni and looking at the letters and so on and, you know, putting them in categories. It's just, we developed a whole program with that. And I started saying, you know what, we're going to use the circulars from the food stores and cut them up and use them in the classroom.
Yeah, I remember doing that too with adults because I taught adults English.
Yes, and you need to know for price comparison and so on. And yeah, very rich language lessons come out of there.
Like cat shopping catalogs and things like that. Yeah. I think we even went to the store once and took them to the store and we did it. But, that was when I was working with a Chinese student and her family, her kids. So we went to the store and, made it kind of a lesson. She brought her kids along and it was
Yep.
fun.
And you know what? I bet you, Colette, that that's the very lesson that this former student is always going to remember. It's that experiential lesson in the trips. My students come back to me years later and say, remember when we went to.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I met this particular student probably it's over 20 years ago, and I kind of lost touch with her and her family. But last year on New Year's Eve, I got a phone call from her son and
Oh.
said, my mom wanted me to reach out to see if this was still your phone number. And she wanted to talk to you and wants to have lunch with you because she, wants to see you again. So it was really nice. It was really nice.
Those are the most incredible moments for us, right? As ESL, ENL teachers that make it worthwhile. It's incredible, right? I got a Mother's Day text from a student I had years ago. She's married now. She's a mother herself. And she said, I want to say happy Mother's Day to you because you were my first mother in the America. And it just like it's like that's why I teach. That's what we call psychic income for us, right? We're not getting bonuses for the holidays, but that's just incredible.
Oh yeah, I agree. That's a wonderful story. I love that. I love that. So I think we've kind of talked about this already, but what specific roles do families of L's or multilingual learners play with regard to early learning?
Well, they are the first teachers of their children, and their response to adversity is picked up. So if families are stressed, and even though they don't, maybe the families don't think the kids understand the language yet, they do understand the body language, the stress, the tension in the air, and they pick up on that, the tone of voice. At the same time, when families are truly tuned in to the youngster, they pick up on that. So they are the first teachers, and everything, what's so important is also for those families who may not have literacy skills in their home language, they're not off the hook. They can tell stories, they can point things out in the environment, they can, sometimes families have to be sort of prepped or trained to understand that our early childhood programs spend a lot of time talking about attributes of objects. We focus on color, shape, number, size. And that's not true in a lot of places around the world and in a lot of languages. Our language kind of forces us to do that, and that gets back to, the Sapir Whorf hypothesis. You have to have the notion of the chicken before the label versus the object, right? So it's just interesting to try to say, look at that big yellow dump truck. Look at that big yellow bus. Well, there's a little yellow bus. The school buses come in different sizes. Some are little and some are big. That's not done in lots of languages, and it focuses on details. Right. So it's interesting because if you look at Spanish or French, it focuses on the gestalt first, the bus, the big, the yellow. And we just think it's adjective placement. But some linguists will say, no, it actually trains your mind to look at details first versus the whole. So people will say English speakers beat around the bush. They tell you all this nonsense. Like, what are you talking about? Right? So it's the graceful, beautiful, tall, thin ballerina. Tell me it's a ballerina first, and then I know what you're talking about. It's very interesting. So I think, families need to be mindful that children who don't talk yet are still learning language. So, I remember having a father say to me, well, what's the difference if I read to my infant a work pamphlet I'm supposed to read or a children's book? It was a good question, you know, but I said, well, how meaningful is the work pamphlet to you? Can you do intonation? Can you show pictures? Can you be excited about it?
Right.
No.
Right.
And modeling and pausing and doing the back and forth and the give and take and the, you know, serve and return kind of thing is important. And I think that as teachers of young children, we have to understand that it's not that there's one way to socialize children. You know, it's very interesting too, you know, with younger children, you see them being amidst lots of older kids who are not that much older, but I've seen 8-year-olds carry around a 14-month-old. And, you know, we're thinking, oh my God, that's against the law. He could drop it, blah, blah. And I've seen some 8-year-olds be very competent. And we all know that, you know, just being a certain age and having a baby doesn't mean you're already prepared.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
We don't prepare our own species to take care. I remember this vividly when my daughter was born prematurely over 30 years ago. And I mean, I was a nervous wreck giving her a bath. I was like, okay, we have the soap, we have the towel, we have this. I was sweating, just, you know, because I had never really held such a tiny being before.
Yeah.
Unless it was a kitten or a puppy, you know?
Right. Right.
So I think it's important to reach out and to acknowledge that families have a lot of information. And the first and foremost, of course, is to understand and know what they call their child, what that name is, and pronounce it accurately.
And I think that speaks a lot to making them feel welcome.
Absolutely. Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
In addition to like acknowledging the home language in the classroom and acknowledging their name and having respect for their beliefs. And are there any additional strategies that we haven't really talked about that might help families feel welcome?
I think this has been a really difficult time for us because not so much at the preschool level, but a little bit if it's a preschool associated with a school district. Since we've had all the school shootings, a lot of schools have put lots of security at the door.
Yeah.
And it's not welcoming.
No.
And that is a very sad fact. So we have to work around that. So sometimes you have to think about putting signs in the window where they see it before they even enter. Because, I mean, in the school districts where, you know, they're so cautious, and I'm not saying they shouldn't be.
Right.
You can't even just walk in anymore to the building.
Nope.
Have to have an appointment. And that's already very off-putting.
Sure.
You know, so that's where I think that the gatekeepers need to be very well trained in smiling and making people welcome and having signs that are visible before the security guard can open the door,
right,
and having recordings in multiple languages that when the families call, they don't have to understand enough English to say, for Punjabi, press 2. For Hindi, press 3. For Spanish. But, you know, somehow there has to be a way for us to figure this out.
Right.
And that's important. And then I think, you know, of course, people do flags from all over the place, and that's very helpful. But one other thing that in the classrooms, I know because of, you know, privacy, we can't have pictures of the children themselves. But I always say to teachers, rather than have pictures like National Geographic or Google Images, why not have pictures of the children themselves?
Yeah.
Because there's nothing like seeing a child that you know or your own child, and the family's face lights up because you see them in action, you know?
Yeah.
And that's something we're coming to terms with, right? But I think that we all have to work harder to make people feel welcome when our schools have become like fortresses. Right. You know, I don't know if that's true in your area, but in our area, it's really a problem.
Yeah, I was thinking because I live in a rural area, and it's a, you know, so it's a smaller school. And when COVID hit, like before COVID, you could just, you know, you could walk in and go right to the registration desk. Now I remember the first time that I went to school to pick up one of my kids, and they said, no, you can't come in. And they stopped me at the door. And I just remember how, like, what a sick feeling I had, yeah. You know, just, and I can't imagine, you know, our parents feeling that same way as well, you know, especially of our multilingual learners.
Right. So it's twofold. It's like, they're not fully comfortable with the language. And now, mm-hmm. even if they can approach the desk, you're wearing a mask, so they can't understand what you're saying. So it's been very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. COVID certainly did not help the situation at all.
No. So that's why thinking about a window or putting posters out or something. Mm-hmm. I know one preschool that I work with, they have these penguins outside for the kids, and they do a contest each year to name the penguins, mm-hmm. and they dress them with different, you know, aspects that look like different backgrounds in terms of little flags on their bellies and whatever, uh-huh. and they have different words, mm-hmm. you know, said hello or welcome, whatever, and mm-hmm. it was cute, you know, because at least it was age appropriate, and it right. was also a way to show you are welcome here, you know, find your penguin kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nice. It's a good way to make a connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about the connection. You're right.
Yeah.
And making people feel that they are welcome, you know, mm-hmm. because even if you speak English, if you have to push a button and wait for a security guard, it's aggravating. And yet nobody would say that they don't want to be safe. We want our kids right. to be safe, but it can be frustrating.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. In your experience, are there specific resources that you have found to be helpful that we might recommend to our listeners?
I think one of the most people probably know, but if they don't, a fabulous app on the phone, because I find that a lot of the families don't rely on email the way many teachers do. Mm-hmm. They use their phones for a lot. Yeah. And the Talking Points free app, if you don't know it, it's fabulous. Mm-hmm. Basically allows you to 28 languages and growing. It was developed by teachers. And so it's a way to communicate to the families in their preferred language. So you put your roster in, you list the students, and you choose their language. And it goes through a relay system. So it's not like you're giving your cell phone number out.
Right.
And it's been so useful because you can send a message in Chinese, in Albanian, in Arabic, in Spanish, in whatever language you want. You type your message in English, they receive it in the language that you've chosen, they type back to you in their language, and you get that message from them in English. And families have just loved that. So that's one. And of course, you know, Colorín Colorado, which most TESOL people know. Mm-hmm. Another great resource for real literacy and phonemic development and awareness is readingbear.org. It's free. And it's really good also for older students who need, like for parents maybe, who want to learn English, because it's not cartoony. I mean, I think that Starfall and all of those early childhood teachers know, but Reading Bear for older people or for families, mm-hmm. has worked well because the kids can sort of connect with it, but it doesn't insult the parent because it's got real photographs and videos rather than, you know, cartoons.
Right. Nice. Right.
And just in terms of early development, I had the good fortune to work with Dr. Catherine Purvis, who's not an educator by trade, if you will. She worked out of a university. She's passed away since, but she worked out of a university in Texas. And she, Catherine Purvis, P-U-R-V-I, I can send you all that.
Okay.
Yeah. She talks about TBRI, which is trust-based relational intervention. So, you know, Colette, my other work, not so much in younger children, but I've worked with students who've experienced trauma and mm-hmm. how that has impacted their ability to trust, to behave, to learn, to form relationships. And she works largely with hard to place foster care kids and has worked with families who don't understand when a kid has a meltdown or a tantrum when they have everything they need, because something in their brain is triggering them to go back to that prior trauma. And we see that a lot with SIFE kids.
Sure.
So, and mind you that some of even our preschoolers have had horrific early experiences that they can't verbalize and they're acting out and teachers don't know why, you know, even sometimes even families don't know why, because there's periods of separation that they've experienced. You know, they spent 2 or 3 years of their life with a grandmother and now they're reunited with a mother. And they don't know which end is up. So they're missing the person who took care of them. And now they have to get to know the mother who left them when they were just a few months old. And the mother who left them doesn't know developmentally from where they came. And it's just, it's difficult. You know, it's all around difficult, but it's really about helping children feel safe and trusting the adults around them. So this trust-based relational intervention is incredible information. The other thing that I think teachers need to know about, not so much resources for families, is the ACE study, the ACE Adverse Childhood Experiences. And that also was something I was shocked that teachers were unaware of. I was not, I mean, that study came out in the 90s, and I, in my training, because it was before that, wasn't given. And I think everybody needs to know the impact of ACEs on students. So, you know, meet families where they are, and sometimes meeting them at times that are best convenient for them may not be convenient for the school. Like I've had to advocate in one building I was in for many years to say, we need Sunday afternoon, early evening meetings for families. And they went nuts. No, we can't open the building, blah, blah. And it starts with providing childcare for the kids so they can bring their children, providing interpreters and translators, and providing food so that it becomes a Sunday night dinner together. When you break bread with people, you feel a connection. And you invest early on with that. It's just wonderful. It's just a wonderful way to make families feel that they're welcome, that it's a center, not for orientation necessarily, where we're going to give you information because we know everything, but we're going to welcome you and ask you about your child and bring in high school students who need community service or just want to do this to help you with the other kids.
Right.
And once or twice, we've actually provided transportation for families because we're in a spread out district, as you are, you know, and they don't all have cars and there's no public transportation. So how are they going to get there? You know, so if you really want to make that connection and you're not doing home visits, you have to think carefully about opening up your building, your program to families.
And I actually worked in a larger district at one point, and they would actually go to the communities and like go to a location within the community.
Right. Okay.
Or like parent teacher conferences.
Right. Right. And at the library or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's another.
Yeah. That's another great idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great idea, because it's within where they are. Right.
Yes. Right. Yep. Yeah. So final thoughts as we wrap up, if you could give one message, what would that be as we wrap up?
One message is that these are tough times, you know, coming out of the pandemic. We're not fully out of it. It's impacted all of us. I think, you know, the old adage, there's so many of them, you know, the Maya Angelou one comes to mind. It's like people won't remember what you said. People won't remember what you did. But they will always remember how you made them feel.
Yes.
And, you know, with older kids, the adage of kids don't care how much you know, they need to know how much you care.
Mm.
So even if you don't know how to communicate, because the child's language is so foreign to you and the way they interact is so foreign, make a connection of any kind to say, wow, you have a black and white shirt today. I have black and white socks. Look. And it has nothing to do with your curriculum, and it has nothing to do with, you know, your learning goals, but it's something about a connection, you know. It's something about a connection. And for the student who's absent a lot and doesn't come, instead of saying, you know, where have you been, or, you know, what's wrong, you know, turn it around and say, I'm so happy you're here today. We really missed you. Mm-hmm. It's a different message.
Right.
Yeah. And getting back to the work of Dr. Bruce Perry and a lot of other people who are looking for the trauma-informed notion is to say, when you're seeing a child act out, to kind of, rather than say, what's the matter with you? What's wrong with you? Yeah. Change it to, what happened to you? What has happened to you? Mm. You know, and that mindset is enormous. If you can just stop for a minute, because most of us as teachers will say, what's the matter with you? Why are you doing this? You know that we talked about this and blah, blah, and you're not going to get a sticker and blah, 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 and all of this. Instead of looking at the behavior and trying to find the source of what is causing the behavior, most schools respond to the behavior, not looking deeper to what caused it.
And they think that that's an the easier solution, the quicker solution.
Right, but it doesn't work, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Suzanne, I have really enjoyed listening to you and talking with you.
Me too. I enjoy talking to you and learning more about your linguistic journey.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Again, thank you for joining me today for this podcast.
It's been a lot of fun. Really good things to think about and move forward.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.